This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Alice Jovich from Arlington, Texas, and you are listening to a special trail running edition of Horses in the Morning for January 21st, episode 1343, brought to you by the North American Trail Ride Conference. Good morning. Oh, and Spalding Fly Predators. Good morning, Horse World.
Last time I checked, today is April 21st, and here we go.
Oh, I have the wrong month pulled up. Jeez, I've got problems.
Just an ordinary day.
If you love to ride horses, but you'd rather ride on a trail than in an arena, I think I know a sport just for you.
We're out. We're getting to the first mark. We're a little ahead of time.
Expect nothing less than full-blown chaos.
Woohoo! Welcome to Technology Hassle Day on Horses in the Morning.
Yeah, when my computer crashed, it took me back to the wrong page. I was just reading what was in front of me, and I was going,
wait a minute, I don't live
in Arlington anymore, and it's not January.
No, it's not January, last time I checked. And it is episode 1411, and it is indeed brought to you by Spalding Fly Predators.
That's right. And I don't live in Arlington anymore. I live in Bluffdale.
There you go. Okay, I think we batted about a 500 on that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So how are Alice?
Well, good, I guess. It's a little waterlogged down here. Had a lot of rain, more rain last night. I think maybe it's not going to rain this weekend, but then I think it's supposed to rain again next week.
So are you where it is actually raining versus where it's not raining but flooding anyway?
No, it's actually raining, but we're not having a lot of flooding. I'm not really sure why. Maybe we just have a better flood control plan than Houston.
There we go.
But I mean, like where I live, Saturday night, it rained really hard. And the lower level of my little house flooded. It's an old house. And so there's like a crack in the side of the concrete on the hill where the house is built. And I think that's where it's coming. It's happened a couple of times, or it comes up from the foundation or something. But I got up and there was like a quarter inch of water over the entire floor. Fortunately, there's nothing on the floor because I know this happens. So, you know.
There you go. Well, at least it wasn't a surprise. So let's get on with what's coming up on today's show, because Glenn and I have traded studios this morning. So, Glenn, what's coming up on today's show?
All the buttons are weird in her studio. They're all different. on today's show, it's a waterlogged NATRC Spalding Fly Predators episode where we talk to the horse savior that everybody saw in the video yesterday. We talked to President's Club winner Esther, and also Tom Spalding of Spalding Fly Predators stops by. We try and get him on once a year to talk about how to use nice critters to get rid of nasty critters. All coming up on today's episode.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Yay!
Sorry, I don't use big words like Jennifer does, because I don't know. I don't understand half of what she says. So, just saying.
Well, we don't typically have Daily Winnies on the NATRC episode, but I do want to do this. There we go. We have three happy birthdays today. My elder brother Dan is his birthday today. Happy birthday, dude. Elisa Wallace, our favorite eventer and Mustang makeover champion. It's her birthday today. And the most important and influential horse gal in the whole wide world, Queen Elizabeth, turns 90 today. And unfortunately, our invitation to her birthday party got lost in the mail. But happy birthday just the same.
We'll be there in spirit.
We'll be there in spirit. Yeah, exactly. Oh, I wish. Moving on to NATRC business, what's this about you riding at the Pol Canyon Ranch ride? Tell me about that.
Oh, Pol Canyon Ranch is a really awesome, cool beautiful place in West Texas. It's in a little town called Kittaque, which is, I'll spell it because you can never find it by the way it sounds. It's Q-U-I-T-A-Q-U-E. And so it looks like Kitaki or something, but it's like there's a sign in the town that says you pronounce it Kittaque or Kittaque. It's in the same town as Caprock Canyon State Park. So if people are looking for places to ride, you know, like trying to get a reference point for where it is. It's a privately held family ranch. It's been in the lady, there's a couple that runs it, but it's been Lynette Bearfield's family for a long, long time. And they've got hookups and a little ranch house you can rent. And every couple years we do a competition out there. And so our competition was 2 weeks ago. The open riders did 53 miles over 2 days. And wow. The novice riders did, I didn't look at the novice map close enough.
But I think they less did, than that.
Well,
they did,
well, they did less than that. It was somewhere between 30 and 40. I know that for sure. But it's such a pretty place to ride. You just kind of, the miles just sort of fly by. And I mean, there's all kinds of red canyons and there's like swallows in the side. And like a couple of times we saw, there was a few places down in the creeks and things where some of the rocks had fallen, like there's big piles of rocks at the bottom of the creek, you know, where that ledge had fallen back. And he's dug quite a few ponds out there and they've had some good water. They had drought for a while and had gotten rid of most of their cattle, if not all of their cattle. And now that the drought seems to have ended, they have cattle again. But their website, if anyone wants to go and just ride there, it's polecanyonranch.com is the name of
it. It sounds beautiful.
It is absolutely gorgeous. It's totally worth the trip. And like I said, they have a house there. So you can always get in that way, you know, and stay in the house because it's very reasonable for the rental. I think it sleeps like 9 or 11 people.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. Now, typically when you go to your rides, this is someone outside the biz, the rides you go to, typically, are there facilities for the horses or is it usually a case of the horses are in some way, shape or form being housed at their trailers?
In this facility, there are pens. They had at one point they had a few pens, but now they have pens for, I think, up to 40 horses.
Wow, that's a lot of pens. How many horses were there? Do you know?
Yeah, I think we started 32.
Wow, that's a great turnout.
Some of them were local people that came for their first ride and did a 1 day ride. And then, so the second day, I think we had about 25. And I think only one person had to pull. One of the horses had a sore back and pulled for the second day, but I think everybody else finished.
Wow.
And it was a lot, you know, and they even have like a big corral. So if you have, like, if you're there with three or four people, I know that when I've gone out there before, I've had that big pen with just our horses, you know, so they had more space even.
And whenever you go out, you had this particular ride, the Pole Canyon Ranch ride. How many divisions were there?
There are three divisions. There's novice and competitive pleasure. We end up calling it CP a lot of times, and open. But there was a 1 day ride for the competitive pleasure division on both days. So
now, explain to me what competitive pleasure means.
Competitive pleasure is kind of in between novice and open. People who have noviced out, who have gotten too many firsts and can't be novice anymore, but maybe they don't want to ride as fast or as far as open, or they have a young horse that they're starting, but they can't ride novice because they've noviced out. Or they're a competitor that just, you know, they are a longtime competitor that maybe just doesn't feel like going the distance, or their horse has gotten older, so they'll drop back and do fewer miles at a little bit slower pace.
Well, that's a really cool idea to have that. The eventing world at the lower levels has that, in that they will frequently have what they call eternally green or evergreen divisions, in that the level of required effort is pretty low, but it's open to anybody, which is a great thing to have because, particularly in this day and age, the demographic of the competitive rider or non-competitive rider is changing. And the people who are coming into our sport might not, for whatever reason, be able to move up the level. So it's great that you guys offer that. So when you're novice, that's the most beginningest level.
Right.
And then there's competitive
pleasure.
And then the level after that is what?
Open.
So that at any given ride that someone would go to at a local level versus a national or something, are those the three levels of competition available everywhere, or are there more that weren't at this particular Pole Canyon Ranch ride?
No, those are the three. If you offer novice, you have to offer competitive pleasure.
Oh.
Because I think in the beginning when they first started competitive pleasure, it was kind of a controversial sort of thing. I mean, I don't think it was it wasn't a completely accepted, because everyone in the beginning, it was like, well, you start in novice and of course you'll move up to open.
Well, exactly. I'm sure that was one of those growth curves when you start this sport. You had to see what your competitors and potential competitors needed. And you have to, any organization has to grow and change with the community it serves. So that makes perfect sense that it started as like, okay, let's try this. And there are going to be some people that are going to question it. That makes perfect sense.
Well, and in fact, in the last year, or starting last season, they added what they call a competitive pleasure national championship. Oh. It used to be you could only earn a national championship if you were an open, but it's become recognized that people don't always want to ride open for whatever reason. They don't have time to condition. You know, people work a lot more hours, I think, than they used to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm guessing that in the 60s when the sport started that, you had a lot of housewives or a lot of women who worked part time. I mean, not that men don't do it too, but the demographic does seem to be women.
Yes.
And so it's harder for people who have full-time careers or more than full-time careers to ride their horses enough, to condition enough to be successful in open. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an organization, we grew to recognize that. So they've adjusted that, you know, that competitive pleasure is sometimes a destination division, that it's not just a stepping stone to ride open.
So competitive pleasure,
yes,
is the level of difficulty is in between novice and open.
Yes.
It is open to people who have earned too many points to be novice anymore.
Right.
Now, once you've gone open, can you go back to competitive pleasure?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's one of those. So I would think that the national championship for competitive pleasure is a pretty hotly contested race, just because you're going to have a reasonable number of riders and horses in there with more experience versus the novice level.
It is. In fact, a lot of people joke that competitive pleasure, because we always call it CP, actually stands for completely perfect. because what you have is you have the lower distance and speed of novice. And so the horses aren't as stressed. So you're not getting as many points off from conditioning and soundness. Mm-hmm. And so the obstacles become way more competitive, like being able to negotiate the obstacles.
And
I'm going to toot my own horn here, which I don't do very often, but my horse Liberty was number one last year in competitive pleasure in the nation.
Ooh, so, really?
Yeah, he was. And the national championship is something more than one person can earn. You earn it by getting either two firsts or one first and two seconds, and one of those has to be out of your state. So, like, I'm from Texas, so I had to earn a first or a second in another state.
Gotcha.
And then you have to earn 75 points, and you have 12 rides to accomplish this.
Oh, so the championship is not the single horse and rider with the most points. It works a little bit like the United States Dressage Federation, which has their medal system where you get a certain number of scores over a certain period of time from a certain number of judges, you get a bronze medal. So when you get to a certain level, you get what they call a national championship. This makes so much more sense now, Alice.
Yes. And then in competitive pleasure, there's a there was a lady from Nebraska who rides a really cool gated Morgan. And I've lost her name at the moment.
Mary, we love you, whoever you are.
Mary. Her name is Mary. I think it's Mary McCoy. I feel bad. Anyway, but she was the overall competitive pleasure champion. Her horse had the highest average score for all the rides she did.
Wow.
And then my horse Liberty was the high point competitive pleasure champion for the year. So it's nice. I mean, they have, because my horse wasn't even competitive on average score, just because his score wasn't as high as Mary's score. So.
Interesting. So it's so funny how each discipline has its own peculiarities on how they score things, what they call things. You know, in the quarter horse business, everything is a world championship, despite the fact that it's only available to a specific group of people, but they still call it a world championship.
Right.
But speaking of champions, Let's right. Why don't we get to our, it looks like our first guest is ready, Justin Nelson. And Alice is going to explain to us just exactly why Justin is a champion in his own right.
Good morning, Justin.
Hello, good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Is Houston any drier today, or is it still raining?
You know, it is drier today, and we thought we were going to get another big band of rain yesterday. Thankfully, we didn't, because I was actually prepared to evacuate my own horses out here, but it turns out that we didn't get as much rain the second round as we did the first, so no more evacuation.
So Justin is here today to talk to us about how he jumped in some floodwaters to save some horses in Houston, and there's been a video circulating, so a lot of people have seen the video. But tell us a little bit about how you came to be there and how you came to you know, because, I mean, it looked like on the video that you just spontaneously decided to jump in and get after getting the horses out.
Yeah, it's pretty much how it happened. Of course, we had the storm come in, and they canceled school. Everything was flooding, so we couldn't get the kids to school. And I was hanging out with my son and my daughter and scrolling through Facebook and saw the news coverage from the barn, Cypress Trail. And normally, I mean, it's not uncommon for that area to flood. And honestly, I've never been over there before to help or anything like that. But I just kind of looked at my daughter, because we had absolutely nothing going on. I said, well, why don't we go over there and just see if they need help with anything. And so we drove over, and as soon as we got there, parked the truck, and everyone was standing on the sideline. There were boats already in the water, so there was a relief effort with boats going on, pushing the majority of the horses out. But there were several, which everyone saw from the news, several horses that were hung up on fences and trees and so on and so forth. And just because the current was pushing them in, and there was a guy standing on the sideline with a life vest, and I asked him, what are you doing? And why aren't you going to go in there and, save? And he was like, well, I'm not going in there. I was like, well, give me a life vest. So I donned the life vest, jumped in, and helped the first horse. And that kind of started a snowball effect. Cause as soon as I got that horse out, someone else was like, well, there's another horse over there. And it just snowballed from there.
Well, it's great that you were a good enough swimmer that you were able to get in there, because I know the currents had to have been pretty strong.
Yeah, the current was really strong. As a matter of fact, after I'd saved three or four of them at that point, there was a police officer that made me get out, because of course the police and the fire department, they didn't want it to turn into a situation where they had to save a person, so I understood that aspect of it. But the video of me saving the gray horse propelling off the bridge, that was kind of the turning point for the whole thing, because at that point they had completely stopped me from getting in, and I was arguing with them because I have a strong swimming history and, of course, a strong background with horses. So I'm like, look, I'm absolutely qualified to do this. Thankfully, there happened to be a judge there that was helping out with the boats, and he came and talked to me, and after talking with him for a little bit, he says, you know what, you are qualified, go ahead and go get that horse, which and that's when all the real news media started, as far as me rappelling and pulling that horse over a log. And actually, I ended up pulling it over three logs and pushed it under one. That was a really bad one, just because where it was at, the current was really bad, which is why they didn't want me in that section. So it did get a little dicey at times, but for the most part, we were able to, we got, last I heard, I think there was, were missing still, and then only one had passed away that I heard of. Well, actually, I saw the one, but we were able to save the great majority of the horses.
Well, and it sounds like the flooding happened pretty suddenly, it wouldn't have, I know a place I used to board would flood occasionally, and it would be like one minute it would look fine, and then all of a sudden it'd be like, oh crud, we need to move these horses now.
Right. And, yeah. It was. I mean, I wouldn't say there were some areas that had like 16 to 20 inches of rain. And then the other part of it was, I guess, the Conroe Dam, which is, I don't know, I guess it's, I think it's downstream actually, but they opened up the dam 100%. And it just, apparently it was just a wall of water that just came rushing through there. And so, I mean, normally they're able to get horses out, and they're usually treading through water and so on and so forth, and also get all their vehicles and trucks out. But this time, I mean, everything got left behind. It was, I think they definitely got caught with their pants down, so to speak. And it came up very quickly.
So, well, turning from this, tell us a little bit about your experience with endurance and trail horses in general. Because I mean, I've known you for several years from, you know, back when you used to ride some of the NATRC rides, but I was telling Jennifer that that you had done the Mongol Derby.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have with. First of all, I love Matrac. I think it is the best foundation for any horse. And even though I don't really participate in it anymore, just simply because of time, the one thing that I love about Matrac is that it puts a good mind on a horse. And then your highest level endurance horses typically have to have a really good mind because they have to know how to relax. So that being the case, I love Matrac. And then from there, you kind of have couple different levels to endurance. Of course, you have AERC, which is our national federation, and the motto there is to finish is to win. So, you know, the emphasis is on horse safety, everyone having fun, and basically, you know, getting horses through it in a safe and controlled manner. Of course, some people do prefer to compete to win, but for the most part, the organization as a whole, of course, is the finishes. And then from there, as you become more competitive and start racing internationally, which is the other thing that I do at an FEI level, then the emphasis is more on trying to win or being very competitive, while at the same time taking care of the horse. Now, the Mongol Derby, however, that's a completely different beast because it's 1,000 kilometers, so approximately 640 miles, I believe. We have 10 days to complete it in. I won it back in 2010. And since then, I've trained a couple other individuals who have won it. But it's set up like a Pony Express. So your first horse is drawn on a lottery system. And then from there, it's a first-come, first-serve. So every horse does 40 kilometers, which is approximately 25 miles, which is equivalent to, in endurance, what we would call an LD. And you have to navigate yourself from checkpoint to checkpoint. When you get to that checkpoint, you can pick from a string of approximately 40 horses that you've never seen before. You grab that horse and you ride to the next checkpoint. We ride from 6 in the morning to 8 at night, and first one across the finish line wins.
And it's my understanding that some of those horses aren't very well trained or even broke in some cases.
They're not. You know, probably, I guess it's been running since 2009 because I did it the second year. So that, I guess, about 6 years that's been going on. This will be year seven. But last year was a very good year. They didn't have very many people injured. But up until that point, I would say about 50% of the field was retired because of the horses.
Wow.
The horses are very well taken care of, but you don't ever really know kind of what you're getting. You have to look for telltale signs that a horse is being ridden, because the way the Mongolians work their horses or have their horses, they don't keep them pinned up. They don't work them every day. Matter of fact, they don't even name them because it's part of their, you know, I guess, spiritual belief. But horses are turned out into the herd, which just naturally graze and go across the land. And usually what they'll do is they tie up one horse every night. And the next morning they get up, they ride into the herd and just catch whatever horses they can, bring them in, saddle them up, and ride them. When they're done for the day, they turn all the horses loose except for one horse, a different one than the night before, and tie it up. So the horses, while they do get ridden, they do get worked, they're never truly domesticated like what you and I horses are doing. You know, they work on side passing and bending and control and all the collection and all those things. They use them for their livelihood, and then they turn them back loose again. So it's a very unique bond that they have. But that being the case, the horses can be semi-wild. And, you know, they probably don't need all those horses all the time. So some horses get ridden more than others. But that's kind of adds to the flavor of the Monroe Derby, because you really never know what you're going to get.
So you're telling me that these horses would not do well at an 8-track ride?
They would fail horribly. I'm pretty sure they wouldn't even be allowed to enter.
Might kick the judge or something.
Oh, absolutely. There would be no trot out. Matter of fact, there are 3-star level vets at the event. So it's very high level vets in the year I was there. They come in and they do an examination just like they do at an HRAC ride or an endurance ride. And then, you know, the vet looks at me and is like, okay, trot your horse out. And I'm like, you got to be joking me. I mean, these horses do not trot.
They're not halter broke. Are you saying they're not halter broke?
No.
Just go ahead and say it.
They are not halter broke. They're nowhere close. Matter of fact, when you get off, half the time they try to escape from you because they know that they're done for the day and they want to get out of there.
Oh, wow.
It can get a little bit Western. Although I think, I've been coaching people throughout the years, and it seems like the horses are getting better and better and they're getting faster because as this race has gained more popularity, I mean, Williams are very competitive people, and it's a horse culture. Horses outnumber people 7-1 there. So for them, they have their Nadan racing, which is their big annual racing that they do. But because the horses are so important to them, and now that this race has really gained in popularity, they're starting to provide probably better horses that are, trained and a little bit easier to handle. And I think that's why we're seeing a decrease in the amount of injuries. Because, the year I was there, we had someone break their collarbone, there was a punctured lung. The year after, there, someone had their finger degloved. I got kicked in the chest with one of the stallions that I picked. I mean, it was a little Western. And I just think, I think as it's been popularity, the horses have just gotten a lot better.
So what's next for you on the competition horizon? Once you all dry out, you can leave Houston.
Well, that's a good question. Because I just got back from Abu Dhabi. We were out there doing the President's Cup. I took two horses out there. And initially, I was going to try out for the U.S. team with those two horses. But instead, I decided to allow two of my young riders. I love working with kids. My daughter's 14, so I've always had a bit of a passion for working with the kids. So I gave up my spot to try to do that, and we went to Abu Dhabi. So that being the case, with one of my young riders, I'm hoping she decides to go to the North American Championships, which would be in, I think, June or July. And then past that, the horse that I took to Abu Dhabi, because I brought both horses home. I didn't sell them over there or anything like that. I'm going to go, hopefully, the national championship and do the 100-mile in that. It's on my birthday, so I'm thinking that would be a great birthday present if we could win it. But either way, we'll see.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about the Houston Rescue and a little bit about the Mongol Derby. It was really fun.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Talk again.
Thanks for stopping, Justin.
Okay, bye.
That was great stuff. That was really fascinating thing to listen to. Now, see, it used to be that you would say when a horse was being naughty or things went awry, it went a little cowboy on me. Now we can say it went a little Mongolian on me.
Or, I like that he said a little Western.
Yeah, it's not a little Western anymore. It's a little Mongolian.
I'm about to start a young horse. I'll have to remember that when I'm taking him to a clinic in a couple of weeks to hopefully be on him by the end of the weekend, and I'll have to remember that.
So hopefully he will not go Mongolian on you.
Hopefully not, yeah.
Well, we're going to jump right across the world this time, and our next guest, Esther, is ready to come and chat with us.
All right, our next guest is Esther Diagula, and she is this year's. It's interesting that Justin was just talking about the President's Cup for endurance. Esther is the President's Cup winner for 2015 for the NATRC. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
We're good. We're hopefully going to have a dry day today. Maybe. I don't know. Are you guys getting all this rain too, or is it just sitting in Texas?
We're getting it hit and miss. For the last few days, it's just been absolutely gorgeous. So we've got low temperatures, low humidity, and we've just been really enjoying April.
So now you're from Florida, right?
Aren't you right? Well, I'm in the panhandle of Florida.
Well, see, I don't think you're too far from Jen and Glenn, or I don't know. I don't know my Florida geography, so.
Panhandle's a little ways up there for
most. Oh, is it? Okay. I don't know where anything is in Florida. I haven't studied the map.
I don't know my way around Texas, so it's all fair.
I mean, I know the Keys are in the South. I've been there, you know. I know where Orlando is.
I'm almost to the Georgia border.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good spot to be in to hit a lot of rides in Region 5 then, because if you were too far south, it'd be harder to get more places.
Yeah. And what the further south you get, the hotter it gets, and the more humid it gets.
Yeah, so, that doesn't sound fun. I don't like hot and humid. So how did you get started riding in ATRC?
Actually, I started with endurance. I did one 25 LD, and one of the ladies there told me that I needed to learn how to rate my horse, and that it would be a good idea to take her into some competitive trail rides first. And that's what I did, and I loved it. And I decided, no, endurance is not for me. I'd rather do the competitive trail rides.
So you enjoyed the obstacles and the extra challenge of the rating versus just going, you know, full out.
Right. I enjoyed that. The other thing that I enjoyed so much is the cards that I got back from the judges and all of the comments on there. That has helped tremendously in my riding and in teaching my horse what I need her to do.
That makes sense. So how many years have you competed now?
15. I've been in it 15 years. Up until about 2 years ago, I could only do one or two rides a year because I was working. And when I retired, I just said, I'm going riding. And we did.
Right. Well, I met you last summer in Missouri.
Right.
And that's what you said. You and your husband were going kind of from ride to ride.
We were going to hit two rides in Region 6, but our plan was to go to Colorado for the summer because Tallahassee is so hot, and we decided we're both retired. We don't have to stay here anymore. So we headed out west, and I was able to fit in two rides out there along the way. I actually wasn't planning on going for the President's Cup to begin with. But Dana and I started sweepstakesing several rides in the spring of 2015, and Bill Moore, Vicky Moore, my husband, and Gary Clayton all convinced me I needed to give it a try. So that's what we did.
So can for people who don't know, can you explain what it means to sweepstakes?
It means that my horse was a high point horse in that particular ride, in that particular division. We have two weight divisions in the open division, which is what I ride. There's heavyweight and lightweight. And my horse has to be the high point horse over both of those divisions.
And they earn extra points for being a sweepstakes winner.
Yes, you get two extra points.
So, and
which
you get,
doesn't sound like much, but they add up.
Yes, they do add up quickly. So tell me a little bit about your horse and how you came to for her to be your partner and about your journey. Excuse me.
Dana was an accident.
Actually,
we had gone down to Palatka to look for a horse for my husband, and we had seen Dana online. She was a 2-year-old filly. And when we got there, my husband looked at her and said, oh, no, she's too small. At that time, she was only 14 hands. And we knew that she wouldn't grow much larger. But there was a horse across the road in another pasture, a tall, rangy colt. And we went back up and told the owner, you know, we don't want the filly, but we do want the colt. And he said, I'm really surprised you don't want that filly. She's really well put together. And I said, she is, but she's too small for my husband. And he looked at me and he says, I'll make you a really good deal. I said, what's a really good deal? And he made me one. So I brought Dana home. It took us 4 hours to load those two horses onto that horse trailer. Neither one of them were broke at all. Nothing.
Must have been a really good deal after 4 hours for you to still want to take her home.
Yes, absolutely. We got her home, and we got Jethro home, and we just started working with him. And I spent 2 years doing nothing but groundwork with Dana before I even put a saddle on her back. So she knew everything from the ground. And she was an amazingly easy horse. When I started working with her, I told my husband, this is a 25-year-old, been there, done that quarter horse in Arab skin.
So she's a purebred Arab?
Yes, she's purebred. She's actually Cravat Mainsborough Kellogg.
So, okay. Good bloodlines.
Yes, very good bloodlines. And she's got a lot of sense, and she's got a lot of opinions.
Ah, well, she's a mare.
Yes, she's a mare.
So, of course, she has a lot of opinions.
Are you saying...
Yeah.
Are you insinuating, Alice, that... Now, this is a curiosity question for Esther. Have you competed, or you or your husband, competed with mares previous to getting this particular filly?
No, actually, the last horse that I competed with was a gelding. My old, he's 27 now. His name is Chagall, and he's a Polish-Arabian. And he just was not cut out for competition. He would just get too nervous, and his head was not in it.
Yeah, he's a stay-at-home guy. So you didn't really have any other mares to compare this particular one to.
I've had different mares, but I never competed mares. Mm-hmm. Dana has been the only mare that I've ever competed.
Now, how does she compare personality-wise on a day-to-day basis with your other mares? Because you said she's opinionated, but is she just simply opinionated, or is it more of the mare type of opinionated that she is? How does she compare to the others?
The others I got rid of.
Well, there you yeah. go.
That's your answer.
Dana is the only mare that I have left.
Oh, it's like at our house, we have one mare amongst all the geldings. Only one that was worthy.
Yeah, and it's not a mareish opinionated. It's like, I know what's best, listen to me, and we'll have a discussion. And I usually win. Sometimes I'm wrong. You know, just the way it goes.
Yeah, it's nice, though, that when some of these horses have such a sense about what should be done, and when you have that relationship with them, you can look at the situation and go, oh, maybe she's onto something here.
Right, yes, and I respect her opinion. I didn't respect it at one of the rides recently, though. I made the horrible, horrible mistake of trying to take her into competitive pleasure, which is a slower pace and a shorter distance, and she hated it. She got so mad at me, she bucked.
Oh, no.
Really?
Bucked. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, were you trying to take it easy on her after working hard last year? Was that...
Yeah, and I wanted to ride with one of my friends that I had ridden with a lot last year, but she retired her horse. Regina Broughton retired Tango, and so she started riding CP on a new horse Sunday. And I thought, you know, it'd really be nice to ride with Regina again. So I tried. It didn't work.
Yeah.
And I said, never again. I will never take Dana back to CP.
I've done that a few times with Liberty. He's done open for a few seasons and then CP. It took... The first two seasons in CP were not good. The third season went really well. But it took him a couple of years to get it in his head that we didn't have to work that hard. Now we're back in open and he's much happier.
And you know, I've heard other people say that they've tried to take their open horses back to CP and it just doesn't work. These horses know their job and they're saying, let me do it.
I always joke, you can't take the open out of the horse.
Right. Yeah.
So you said you went to Missouri and you made it out to Colorado. How many did you do some rides in Colorado while you were there over the summer?
No, I actually only did the ride in Missouri, and then I did the ride in Fairbury, Nebraska, the Pony Express.
Oh, yeah.
And then I headed back to Region 5 for the rest of my rides.
Okay.
And I would encourage anybody that if you want to go out of region to do a particular ride, Pony Express is wonderful.
I'm going to that one this year.
I love that ride.
I've already signed up for that one this year. It's in August.
Oh, you're going to love it.
Yeah, it's August. That's the last weekend in August, I think. Because I went to the Indian Cave ride in Nebraska last year. I thought I'd try a different Nebraska ride. It's amazingly easy to get to Nebraska. I thought it was farther away than it was.
Yeah, it is easy to get to Nebraska. And the other thing with the Pony Express last year, even though it was in August, the first day it was kind of a misty drizzle and kept the temps down. The second day, we rode more than half the ride in fog, and it was just magical. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I saw some pictures from it. It looked really pretty.
It was. And I love going through the old Pony Express station.
Yes, that'll be fun to do. So what was the hardest ride that you did?
That was really a toss-up between two of them. The Von Holten Ranch ride in Missouri, that was a tough ride. We had a heat index of 106 degrees.
Is it that hot?
Mud.
I remember it being hot, but...
Yeah, it was. With the humidity and the heat index was up there. The ride manager was a new ride manager. She had never ridden Natrax, so she didn't fully understand about the pacing, about what 30 horses going over the same trails time after time would do to the trails. She decided to make it a faster ride for Open because she heard that Open didn't like to stop for lunch. Mm-hmm. Our horses were pretty badly stressed. When I came back in on Sunday afternoon, I had buckets of water trying to sponge my horse down and get her cooled down while my husband is behind me sponging me down trying to get me cooled down.
It was really
it
hot.
That
was the ride where we met. Yeah, I'm from Missouri originally, and people talk about Texas being hot, and I'm like, Missouri's worse because you have the heat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was bad. The other ride that was bad... and the ride manager is a wonderful ride manager, and she just had bad luck. That was Georgia on My Mind, and it rained and rained. It rained days before the ride. It rained during the ride, just a pounding rain. The trails were really bad, and, of course, you're dealing with that Georgia red clay and hills. So the horses, instead of trying to walk down the hills, they're skiing down these hills.
Yes.
It's primitive camping, so the horses are tied to the trailer at night with that pounding rain coming down on them. They couldn't get any sleep, and everybody was just miserable, and I felt so bad for Patricia. She tried so hard to make it a good ride, and it really is. Fawcett Farms is a beautiful place. The year before, the owner had planted 600,000, I think it was 600,000, mammoth sunflowers.
Wow.
And it was so much fun to ride, you know, by these huge sunflowers. But this past year, it was just a little rough.
Yeah.
You gotta be a tough customer to do this NATRC thing, Alice and Esther. Goodness. This is not for the faint of heart.
Oh, well, I mean, if you go to a novice ride, it's easier. I mean, getting started, it's very accessible to get started. I mean, you know, what Esther's talking about is, you know, the higher, the faster, harder end. So
I'm curious for Esther, whenever you are choosing a ride to return to, you've been there before and you're going back again, or choosing a ride that you want to go to, what are the top three factors that go into your choice, into that? These are the three things that I look for, avoid. What are those three markers that say, this is a ride I either will or will not attend?
The first thing are the trails. I want nice trails. I don't care if they're technical. The Edge ride in East Fork Stables, Jamestown, Tennessee, has some technical trail on it, but it's a lot of fun. The second thing is ride management. How well the ride is run, the timing. Sometimes you'll get a ride manager that's not familiar enough with Natrax to realize that on this particular trail, you've got to go slower, or on this particular trail, you can go faster. So you adjust your times accordingly. And the third one, I don't know. I mean, those are the top two that I look at, is the trail and the ride management.
So what if we drill down just a little bit further, what makes a trail, because you said it can be technical or not, what makes a trail good?
A good trail is a trail that is going to have some challenges to it, but it's also going to have some areas where you can move out if you need to make up time. You need to have at least a few places where you can canter along and be nice and comfortable. Scenery is nice. I like to see a lot of nice scenery. There are some rides that we're riding along the river. It's beautiful. Or in the mountains where you can get some really good views down in the valleys. So it just depends. And so, trees.
And trees.
I love trees.
Great scenery and a variety of terrain is what that sounds like.
Yes.
And not hopefully not too much mud or too much heat.
Yeah, we don't like the mud. We don't like the heat. Humidity is okay as long as ride management realizes about the humidity and adjusts the time accordingly.
Sounds good. Well, Esther, thank you so much for coming on. It's been really interesting talking about your journey, and good luck to you and Dana this year as you go on and participate in NATRC, I guess in open again, since Dana doesn't like being at CP.
You know, we're just kind of taking it easy this year. She had a really strenuous year last year, and part of it was for 4 months when we were out of region, she was stuck in a stall when she wasn't being ridden or hand walked. There was no place that I could turn her out. So this year we're going to take it a little easier.
So she's probably enjoying being a horse.
Yes, she is, very much so.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show, and good luck to you.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Bye.
That was a lot of fun. I was being selfish and asking Esther lots of questions because I wanted some tips for Horse Tip Daily.
Those are good. Those are good questions.
And I was really curious because good is such a subjective word.
Right.
What makes good? And that made perfect sense because when I'm hacking about the neighborhood here or going on a local trail ride at one of the local trailheads here, that on the same way, I don't want to go for a trail ride where it's just a big flat open plain or just up and down and up and down and up and down continuously. It's so much fun to have a variety of terrain and a variety of flora and fauna to oogle over when you go out for a ride.
Well, and I know for myself that like when I consider a ride being good, you know, like what she said, the management, the trails, but, you know, a fringe benefit is because I still don't have a complete living quarters trailer. I mean, I have a better trailer, but if it has a bathroom with a shower, that's just, you know, I'm almost always in for that ride.
See, for me, that's a deal breaker. If there's not hot and cold running water right there for me, I'm out.
Oh, no, I'll go anyway.
My days of sleeping in the horse trailer, and there were many of them, let me tell you, are over, I'm afraid to say. I paid my dues.
Well, you won't feel that way if you start doing more of these with your new horse, you will find that you may change your mind, especially like if you get yourself a little weekend package that's insulated and has a little shower in it, and you can have your own hot and cold running.
Oh, see that, Glenn? We're going to go horse trailer shopping at Rolex. Yay!
There you go.
See, Glenn didn't respond. That means he's not paying attention.
That means that means yes.
That means yes, absolutely.
So yeah, that means Alice is buying. That's what that means.
Hey, you know, eventually I'll move up in trailer. I'll sell you the big one I have. But you'll need a fairly good.
See, the problem with the bigger trailer is then we need a bigger truck. The whole truck and trailer thing is a snowball sliding down a hill. And at the end of it, it's about $100,000 bill is how it all works out.
It's true. Well, it doesn't have to be. I mean, my steel trailer was only $5,000, so.
Yeah, but then you add the truck that can pull it, and then you're getting up there.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. We have this half-ton truck. We are not pulling anything over a two-horse, you know, little tiny trailer.
You're right.
I'm going to be sleeping in the back seat of our four-door pickup truck.
You know, they make some really cute little living quarters trailers that are bumper pulls that you can pull with a half-ton truck. I mean, it's not necessarily the best idea, but it can be done.
Those going down the road, and the whole hitch is dragging on the highway.
That's the one dragging the ground. Oh my gosh, that's funny. Oh,
and we've all seen them, haven't we, at horse shows where you pull in and there's that rig and it's just got a V in the middle. And pretty much the chains are dragging the ground.
Yeah, well, that's when you get the equalizer hitch to go with it. That helps a lot.
See,
yeah, but those people don't know about they don't know about the equalizer hitch, do they?
Now they do. I just told them.
We need to get an equalizer hitch sponsor, Glenn.
There you go.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. Well, why don't we take a little break and listen to some Kristen Harris? And when we get back, we're going to talk to Tom Spaulding of Spaulding Fly Predators.
do what a horse has got to do. Dignified and graceful, but kind of goofy too. 1,000 pounds of might, but too hot tail at the sight of a crumpled bag that blew by. A horse has got to do what a horse has got to do. Nothing's gonna change the way you think, that's true. You may not believe it's so, but you never really know what a horse has got to do. I think you rolled in muddy ground, just so I'll have to rub you down. And when you get a bath, you make sure I get one too. I get as wet as you. A horse has got to do what a horse has got to do. So, but you never really know what a horse has gotta do. Till the hair comes off. A horse has got to do what a horse has got to do. I won't forget the tender gaze I had from you. With a starry night so clear, velvet muzzle on my ear, when my heart was breaking. A horse has got to do what a horse has got to do.
Kristen Harris, and the song's called What a Horse Has Gotta Do. If you love Kristen Harris like I do, you can go to her website, kristenharris.com, to find her music. Today's show is brought to you by the NATRC, as well as Spalding Fly Predators. And it looks like we might be getting Tom here on the line. Is he ready, Alice?
I don't know. Is he ready?
Is Tom ready? No, he's not.
Okay.
All right. So what we with all the flooding going on in Texas, and someplace every year floods. This is not like this is news. We thought it might be interesting and useful to go over a little list of what to take care of when there's going to be flooding happening. And you got a little list for us, Alice.
Right. Because, I mean, you know, a few years ago it was Colorado. Now it's here. It's somewhere, you know, somewhere's always in a drought. Somewhere's always flooding, it seems. You can't have perfect weather everywhere all the time, unfortunately.
Oh, man.
I know. It's terrible. This article that I'm quoting is from, it was written on a blog for somebody who was in Colorado when they had flooding. And they said, number one, find out if your property is in the flood zone. You can research this by contacting FEMA. It should be on the FEMA website, or your town and county planning department is also a good source of information.
And all the time when you buy your home, they check that for you when
yes.
you buy a piece of property. But those lists are updated on a pretty regular basis. So when you bought your farm 12 years ago, you might not have been on a floodplain. But it's advisable to check regularly because that can change.
Right. And also, if your horses aren't where your house is, like a lot of houses aren't allowed to be built in floodplains, or there's certain
right.
things that have to be done.
Right.
But if you're talking about like a barn, you know, barns are often allowed in floodplains, and maybe it hasn't flooded in
right.
200 years.
Yeah, good point.
So, I mean, because that happened where I boarded at a place that flooded a couple times while I was there. And, you know, we knew it was floodplain, but fortunately it wasn't typically a problem. But whenever they would, it, and a lot of times it didn't even rain that much where we had our problem. It rained upstream. And then when they would open the floodgates for the different lakes and things, then it would have.
That would suck.
So, but yeah, so then number two is to design your property to allow each horse to get safe high ground. This is critical because you may not be there when there's a flood. And again, that's like happened. This was a barn where we boarded. We would go out twice a day. We had a rotating group. We had like a co-op. So we'd go out twice a day to feed or whatever. And like in the morning, things looked fine. And most of us would be at work during the day. Well, the person came out in the afternoon and all of a sudden it was in danger of flooding. And it wasn't even raining the day that it started to flood.
Yeah, that's kind of scary, that whole flash flood issue. So that's a good point, is to set things up so that you, if at least when it's the kind of minor flooding that doesn't completely cover up the fence, your horse can stay safe on some high ground. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that was a problem, you know, because it just happened. So, you know, just because it can be so sudden. So number three is to think ahead for the survival of your barn during severe weather events. So if you have electricity, you know, electrical items should be kept off the floor. You don't want any cords left out or things plugged in. You know, theoretically, in a flood situation, the electric company should turn off the electricity. But if you see that there's about to be a flood, sometimes you have to call them and tell them, well, goodness, hey, we're about to
flip
flood.
Flip the breaker box if nothing
yes,
else.
That's
just
true.
You just go to the breaker, and if you just flip the main breaker, all of the electricity into your property is going to be shut off. And I never even thought of that, but that's probably a wise thing to do in that, like, well, now nothing can short out and catch on fire because there's no power going in.
Right.
Good one. I like it.
And also, like, the way you design your barn, if you know your barn's in a floodplain, like if you have solid walls, for example, in your stalls, like our stalls would catch a ton of silt and just nastiness because we'd have to dig out. Oh my gosh, it was such stinky, awful hard work. You get, like, once the flood weathers went down, you have to dig out
the
stall.
There's nothing quite like flood silt as far as the odor is concerned. Yeah.
Right. And then you know, about the dead fish.
You'll never forget it. Yeah.
All the dead fish and all the debris. And,
yeah,
you know, here we were, a bunch of girls. We did have a few husbands that would come help, but, you know, we didn't have a tractor. So it was,
that's backbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah. It was hard. And I know that, like, we went in early to get a bunch of our stuff out and to move the horses. One of the pastures was high. So we just put everybody in that pasture. But, you know, then somebody realized that they had left something behind. And by the time they went back, it was
too late.
There was a little, well, no, they were able to get in, but the culvert across the road was a problem, you know, because you couldn't hardly see and they almost drove off into the floodwater. Yeah. So it was bad.
Wow.
So
what's next on our list?
That is all on this list.
Well, I had I read this list earlier this morning when I was going over the show notes. And it got me to thinking, because some of the shows I recorded earlier with this week are with hosts or guests who are also experiencing flooding in Texas or elsewhere. And the one gal was having trouble actually getting to the barn. And that got me to thinking, well before it's flood season and there's a danger of, understand alternate routes to get to your property. And an alternate route to get to your property may very well involve parking in a next door neighbor's house and hoofing it across their acreage to get to your acreage, or using a gator or a rowboat. But that's certainly a better option than not being able to get there at all, because it could be the roads flood in such a way that you literally cannot get through with an automobile on a road. But if you are planning ahead and you have a good relationship with your neighbors, you can go over there and get to your barn and make sure your animals are safe and everybody is in good condition if evacuating is not an option. So
I was thinking too, you probably want to, if your horse trailers are stored at the barn, you probably want to try to get them out too, because I can't even imagine, aside from the potential of your trailer being washed away, you also have, you know, if it gets wet, that's going to wreak havoc on
it's going to be
all of the moving parts of the trailer.
Another one that I got to thinking about, because we used to get snowed out of our stables up north in Massachusetts. We never got flooded out, but we got snowed out pretty regularly. If we had a really bad nor'easter come in, we could plan on literally not being able to get to the barn for 24 to 48 hours. So we had to do our best to set things up so that the horses would be as safe as possible while we were away. And one of the things you can do in the case of flooding, if you have to keep your hay at ground level, which is what most people do nowadays, very few people use hay lofts anymore. Mm-hmm. If you do keep your hay at ground level and you cannot set it up on something that's a foot high or 2 or 3 feet high, what you can do is the first layer of hay, or the first two layers of hay, depending on the risk of floodwaters, completely cover the top of it with waterproof tarps or plastic, nice heavy-duty plastic that won't get holes in it, and real waterproof tarps, not the cheapy kind that really aren't waterproof. Completely cover those and tuck it in around the edges so that as that floodwater comes in, it's going to soak that bottom layer and it's going to absorb water, but it's going to cut to the plastic and stop so that the layers above it are not going to get saturated. Yeah. So that's a way to help safeguard some of your hay stores and reduce the risk of all of your hay being completely ruined. That was one of the things that we learned. And also set up your horses if they're in stalls and you feel comfortable that your horses are going to be safe in their stalls, but they're liable to get wet at foot level. Tie up the hay nets. Make sure your horses understand how to eat out of them. Practice that in advance. And tie up hay nets in the stall, and I say hay nets plural, with enough hay to last them that anticipated 24 hours.
Right.
So that they have something to nibble on, because that reduces their stress, helps keep them from getting upset tummies. Hang up some extra water buckets, or if you're the kind of folks who use water troughs inside your stalls, like some people will use a large clean trash barrel in an emergency, or a muck tub that is set aside for just that use. Do those kinds of things well in advance. And again, if you practice that once in a while, just for fun, then when it does happen during an emergency situation, your horses are less likely to be freaked out. I will occasionally we have one muck tub that's just for water and for hay. We never put muck in it. We'll put that in the corner of the stall for our horses and fill it full of water when they're in the stall overnight or something, just so that they understand that that's just a barrel of water and it's no big deal and I can drink out of it. Because you know how horses are, if it's a strange bucket they've never met before, they don't want to drink out of it.
Right. And you don't want them drinking the floodwaters.
No, that's a bad idea. That's the stinky dead fish you referred to earlier.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they're thirsty and they don't have other water, they're going to drink the flood water. Cause
yeah, that's bad. When you were a kid, did you read Misty of Chincoteague?
Oh yeah.
See, the ponies that drank the flood water that had been washed inland was salty and the ponies died. We don't want that. That would be bad. So again, those are just some things to think about. And again, think about them in advance, not the day and the 5 minutes after your NOAA alarm goes off. That's not the time to make these plans.
See, I'm where I live now. I'm lucky. I mean, there's a river and it has come out of its bank, but there's like three layers. So I'm way up high. So I don't ever have to worry about the.
Now I looked at the picture in the blog post that you were referring to earlier, which we found on, let me find the name of the website. Blog.classic-equine.com is where we found that one. And in the picture, the horse is standing in what is obviously a flooded paddock because the water is up halfway up his cannon bones. I feel bad for the poor guy. And behind him is probably the muck heap. Looks pretty significant in size. But if I had a place where I had paddocks that seemed to be low-lying, I might invest in some some dump trucks full of what they call clean fill, which is a mixed up aggregate of dirt products that has no trash in it. It's just, it'll be ground up roadbed or it'll be broken up cinder blocks and bricks and things like that. But they use it for fill. And I might invest in a few loads of that so that I could have a section of my field that's a foot or three higher, that if I had three horses in that paddock, that all three horses could comfortably stand on top of.
Right.
And I might put that in there real soon after I move in, so I can say, you know, at least if I get a foot or three of water, my horse can stand atop that. I can put a big old pile of hay up there and a little water barrel for everybody, and they can stand around safely and not – because that just – Maybe it's just a psychological thing for me, but that horse standing there in knee-deep flood water just kind of freaks me out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that the horses probably don't like it much either.
I wouldn't think so.
So, well, we're ready with our next guest. It is Tom Spalding of Spalding Fly Predators, and he is a new NATRC sponsor. He's going to talk to us a little bit about how fly predators work and how they are beneficial. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
Well, we're doing great. It's a beautiful sunny day, and I'm in Reno, Nevada.
Oh, I was in Reno in February. That's where we met.
So, yes.
At the convention. No.
And as Reno, the weather's going to change, and tomorrow we'll have snow and rain. So.
Well, at least, but you're probably not going to have flooding or that huge blizzard that they had in Colorado.
No. I just heard you were talking about that, and yeah, no, it's a quick storm blowing through, and California can use the water, and us too.
Yeah, I know. When I was out there, I was so busy with our convention, I didn't leave the hotel hardly. But I saw it from when I flew in and out, and it's very pretty out there. So.
We enjoy it. Have lived in a number of places across the country, from Southern California, then spent many years on the East Coast, and back to Silicon Valley, and then now here. Every place is pretty, you know. Quite honestly, and they all have their attributes, and we've been honored to live in lots of neat places, and Reno is certainly a pretty neat place.
That's cool. That's neat. I've pretty much only, well, I don't know. I've traveled a little bit, but all in the Midwest, and I know what you mean. I always like the new adventure of a new place. So, I wanted to ask you some questions about the fly predators. Just start with telling us as simply as possible how they work. I mean, you know, cause I know people are real confused about how the bugs actually kill flies, and you know, it's, people look at that and like, I've used them for years. I think they're awesome.
Well, basically, fly predators are a beneficial insect, and by beneficial meaning that, hey, they're good, and in fact, they're all good, and there's really no negative to them. They're naturally occurring. Everybody has some of them already, and all we're actually doing is increasing their population slightly higher than normal, and that will suppress the flies to way lower than normal. Nobody's ever noticed them for, you know, and I say these are native to all of North America and other species to around the world, and they are technically a fly parasite. And what they do, a life cycle of an insect, a flying insect, like a fly predator or a pest fly, they lay an egg, and that egg hatches into a larval stage. In the case of the fly, it's the maggot, and then a maggot eating through the manure, which is, flies are decomposers, and that's the larval stage, the maggot. And then they form a cocoon, and just like a caterpillar turns into a butterfly inside a cocoon, the pest fly turns in from a maggot into a winged insect inside that cocoon, and out it pops, you know. And that can take as few as 8 days at summertime temperatures. And flies lay an incredible amount of eggs. Each female lays roughly 900 eggs, and they can go from an egg to a fly in as few as 8 days. And that's just, you know, phenomenal reproduction potential. And if you didn't have beneficials like fly predators, but also beetles and mites that and other animals, you know, not animals, but other insects, and birds and that also predate on flies, you'd be knee-deep in flies. I mean, literally. And so nobody's never ever noticed their fly predators have had on their property because they don't act like a fly. They're very tiny, about 1/8 the size of a pest fly, and they hang out strictly near the manure, which is what they're looking for in their life cycle. They don't form a cocoon, so they need to take over somebody else's cocoon, and they're specific just to the pest flies we'd like to get rid of, and that they'll come along and find the cocoon of the pest fly, which is in the latter stage of development before it turns into a fly. Out of that 8 days, it's the last 3 days in the cocoon stage. Fly predators find that pest fly cocoon, lay her egg in it, and that kills the immature fly, and then what's going to come out of that fly cocoon is a good guy, a fly predator. And so you'll never notice them. They don't feed like a pest fly. They don't crawl on animals. They don't crawl on people. And unless you get your nose right down on manure, you never see them. So they're all good. And it's the right way to fix a fly problem because you're getting the fly and stopping it before it gets out to reproduce. And so you can really fix the problem. That's the beauty of it. You can really fix a fly problem and have very few flies all summer, as opposed to trying to chase adults and kill adults and, you know, and or just repel them.
That makes sense. And do they reproduce from year to year, or do you have to replenish them?
You need to replenish them because they do reproduce. I mean, they're very active controlling pest flies for you is their reproduction stage, okay? And so, but they don't want to get rid of every fly because they need the flies in order to reproduce. So when left alone, they reach a balance that, you know, hey, there's enough fly cocoons out here for us to reproduce. But that means that there's a lot of flies flying around that you'd just soon not have. So what we're doing is cranking up the population to a unsustainable level in a normally balanced world where you have more fly predators than you would normally have, and that wouldn't be sustainable because they would have run out of cocoons. But there's no negative impact of keeping them slightly higher than normal because it just means that a bunch of them go unfulfilled, so to speak, and that they can't find enough fly cocoons to lay all their eggs in. Each female fly predator lays 70 eggs, and so that they keep searching, but they can't find any. But that also means you have hardly any flies. So while they're, you know, I don't know if they're suffering, but basically why they're out running around trying to find fly cocoons that not enough of them exist for them, you're enjoying very, very few flies. So that's the normal protocol for using them is you start just before you would see flies, and we have mapped 40 years worth of weather data so we can, based on zip code, can tell you when we would recommend starting. So you start them just before you see flies, but after the last hard frost, or the last likely hard frost, and you put them out every 4 weeks during the summer months, stopping about a month before you're done with flies. And you need to do that every year, and they will, the ones you have in that you put out the last shipment, and in fact, the offspring of the first batch you put out will work all summer long, but they can't keep up with the flies' increasing fly reproduction rate, and so that's why you need to keep putting more out every summer. So the subsequent shipments that people will receive are just augmenting that first generation. But all those that are around at the end of the season, as it cools down and it gets below 47 degrees, they go into hibernation mode, and those guys, if they don't freeze over the winter, will be around for the second next year and the year after and the year after.
Okay. This I'm just so curious about all this. My question is, we live in a more urban atmosphere here in that there are, you know, 3 to 5 acre lots, each of which have a few horses. So many, many of the properties have their own little muck heap. Some of the properties have rather large muck heaps, unfortunately. So if I have 3 or 4 acres here and 2 or 3 horses, and I'm using my fly predators on my little muck heap that gets taken out 4 times a year, so in the meanwhile, it needs to have its flies taken care of. But my next door neighbor who lives 175 yards away does the same thing. How far apart would these predators generally have an effect? In other words, if we've got muck heaps that are 175 yards apart, we need to seed those muck heaps separately?
Yes. Yeah, our fly predators, the range... Part of the thing we do as Spalding Labs for fly control is a tremendous amount of education and telling people where flies are coming from and which flies come from where and what you can do in addition to fly predators, because there's lots of other things you can do to basically dramatically reduce the fly reproduction. So it's a education, you know, process. But basically the typical flies you'll have around horses are two kinds of flies. There's the house fly, which is the fly that's on the face of your horse going for the moisture in the eyes. That's the fly that would be trying to get in your kitchen. That's a fly that's in the barn. If the flies are coming from horse manure, the house fly is typically 80% of your flies. Okay. The other fly that you typically have is called a biting stable fly. That's the fly that looks like a house fly, and if you look really closely, it has this little sharp pointer and it's a blood feeder, and it's a fly that will be on the legs and flanks of your horses. So
it's
if
got
you're
bows.
Got horses,
yeah,
double whammy.
Yep. Me too.
Yep. So if you got those and your horses are stomping and twitching, that's a biting stable fly. House fly can't bite. Now that fly isn't going to come to your kitchen. It acts completely different than a house fly. You also have different kinds of traps for them. I mean, the traps people use for house flies, and in fact, the traps most stores only sell a house fly trap. They're like the ones you add liquid to. Those are only for house flies. A biting stable fly won't even think about coming to that. Now, those flies both reproduce in horse manure, but the biting stable fly can also reproduce in spoiled vegetation. So somebody that doesn't have an animal, but has an old round bale's been sitting out in the pasture all winter, or is feeding from cows from a round bale ring and never moves the round bale ring, just keeps throwing old hay on top, new hay on top of old hay. Well, that fly can reproduce in that material. I mean, we have golf courses that just, you know, have a pile of grass clippings and enough moisture, and so the different kinds of flies go different distances and come from different places. So the compost pile is going to, if it's just a muck pile, is primarily going to produce house flies unless, and 20% biting stable flies, unless it's got a lot of bedding in it. And then if it's got a bedding and manure, it can produce more biting stable flies. If you only have, you know, a compost pile that's a true compost pile with no manure, then it's only going to, mostly going to produce biting stable flies.
I didn't know all this.
I know, I had no idea.
And your question on distance, well, a little bit of fly savvy goes a long way of getting rid of these little stinkers. So the house fly goes about a quarter mile, which is 1,400 feet, 300 yards, and 400 yards. So, or actually 500 yards, excuse me. And the biting stable fly can go several miles, you know, so that they can come from dramatically different areas. So in your first question about, well, you know, 175 yards away, they got a muck pile. Do you need to put fly predators there? And the answer is yes, because our little bugs go a maximum of 300 feet, and we recommend 150 feet, that you should not force them to go fast a lot farther than 150 feet. 300, you know, feet is, you know, a length of a football field, and that's a long, long way for a little tiny bug to go that's 1/9 the size of a fly. So they could eventually get there, but it's going to take most of their life. So it really, really helps to put the fly predators close enough. 50 feet is good enough. You can do a pasture, and you know, you can do it at a full gallop. You just don't expect them to get that a long, long distance. So it pays to be neighborly, to get your neighbors to use fly predators, and or if you got neighbors adjacent to you, throw some of yours over the fence, you know, if you can't talk them into using fly predators.
So,
but the nice thing is, even the grumpiest old neighbor generally doesn't like flies. So if you can show them that your horses are doing better than theirs, in many cases they come around.
I say, but it sounds like even if you can't get your neighbors to do it, that it still will help you, even if, you know, it's just not going to be as beneficial. But it still sounds like it will help, even if you can only do it on your own property.
Yeah, most of your flies are coming from your animals. You know, so most people's flies are self-inflicted. They're coming from their animals. And the neighbor that ever picks up, well, they're going to have more flies than you. You'll be sending them a few flies. They'll be sending you more flies. Now, again, it depends on wind direction. I mean, if you're downwind from a dairy, I mean, it's the dairy that's sending you a phenomenal amount of flies as opposed to, and so it depends on the ratio. I mean, if somebody's got 20 horses and you got two, well,
right,
the 20 horses are going to produce many more flies than two unless you manage the manure and or use, you know, fly critters.
So are there any precautions? I mean, I know, like, you can't spray chemical fly sprays around the predators because that will kill them, but are there any other precautions that you need to take when putting your fly predators out? Are there any predators of them on the ground that you have to watch out for?
You have to, well, basically on sprays, I mean, there's additional insects that are beneficial insects that predate on flies besides fly predators. Commercially, the only thing that makes sense to produce are the fly predators, but there's beetles and mites and that also are beneficial. So the main thing you don't want to do, and again, we have this mostly in commercial situations, is you don't want to call the spray guy and have him spray the whole barn and spray the manure piles, and just because that will clobber all the good guys more so than it clobbers the pest flies. And suddenly, half, you know, a huge amount of your natural fly control is disappeared because you've killed them all with pesticide sprays. With people, you have people that spray their horse, and the only thing you need to do when you're spraying your horse is don't spray your horse inside your barn. You know, walk them outside, spray them, because it's just the thing we worry about is the drift from the spray, which is relatively minor, so it's not much. But the fly predators are only going to be in manure areas. But if you spray them in the breezeway and it drifts into the stalls, well, that's an area that some flies can reproduce. So nobody wants to be standing in a pile of manure spraying your horse. So for the most part, it's a non-issue. Some people have spray systems in their barn, and in that case, you would not, because that's a constant, ongoing dosages of pesticides, and you would not want to be putting fly predators in the barn. But most people don't spray their manure piles now. I mean, they used to, and so it's, you know, the impact of pesticides on the fly predators with horses is pretty small. I mean, you don't need to worry about them. If you do have a barn spray system, you know, for most part, you could turn it off if you're using fly predators, because you won't have many fly predators. I mean, you won't have many flies, but we still have customers that use them, but they use the fly predators out in the pastures and in the corrals.
What about fire ants or that kind of thing? Do they eat the fly predators?
Yep. Fire ants are a voracious predator of all kinds of insects, including our fly predators, and chickens. If you got chickens or guineas, you got to be a little sneaky where you put them. You know, if you have free-range chickens, you need to kind of put them in a spot that chickens don't get to and don't see you putting them out. You know, our chickens run to the bush where we put our fly predators out, and that's, you know, so they're, and they will, the fly predators are at risk when you're first putting them out, because we ship them actually in a pest fly cocoon that's been parasitized by fly predators. So the little dark things that look like little brown grains of rice is actually a fly cocoon in a mixture of wood shavings, and what will come out is a fly predator. So, but once they've come out, they're so tiny and they're mobile, and you know, they, not many things get them. Same thing with fire ants. They'll eat them. So if you have ants, what you need to do is try and put them away from where the fire ants would get to them, and or you can put them up in a tree in a cup, and typically the ants don't go all the way up the tree and all the way out a limb to get them, and if they are, then you can use sticky stuff called tanglefoot on the trunk of the tree so the ants won't cross the sticky tanglefoot. And again, we don't have to do that many times, but basically, you know, fire ants are, you know, can be a problem. What can also happen is you don't have ticks and you don't have lots of other things when you have fire ants around, so they're good in that respect. But basically, and when people get rid of the fire ants, suddenly all those things can come back too. But it's from a fly predator standpoint, you just have to apply them a little differently. Not too difficult to do.
Okay, good to know. And where can we get a hold of you? Where can people find you so they can get started on their fly control? Because it's time to do that now.
Basically, if you go to our website, which is Spalding, S-P-A-L-D-I-N-G, without a U, hyphen labs, L-A-B-S, .com, or search for fly predators, then we've got a tremendous amount of information on our website. Our phone number to call is 800-732-2563. That's 800-732-2563. I would suggest, we have a great video, in fact, a number of them, on fly control and a whole pile of them on horse training and horse riding and horse sports and stuff on our website. A bunch of music stuff, too, with Michael Martin Murphy and Marianne Kennedy. But if you're interested in using fly predators, our video that will show you how to use them is on our website as well. You just go to the videos and search for fly control for horses. And that has a great video there. We also have a video on using fly traps, because fly traps are complement to fly predators, and they will get adult flies that might have come in from your neighbors.
Oh, awesome.
So if you got neighbors that are sending you flies, then part of the defense is using fly traps to get those adult flies that came from off your property.
Thank you so much for coming and talking about it. I understand. I've been using these for years, but now I understand how they work so much better. How about you, Jen?
Makes a huge difference. I didn't know any of this stuff. I knew that they were little bugs. I knew that they got rid of your flies, but that was about the extent of it. I'm fascinated.
Well, they're pretty cool little bugs, and they're, you know, make a huge difference. And, you know, when we first started 40 years ago, it was kind of like, man, everybody thought, man, these guys are crazy. And putting out bugs to get rid of bugs, this seems like such a silly idea. But it works really, really well. And the nice thing about it is, say, you're getting the fly before it gets out to get to reproduce. The problem with using traps and baits and those other things is you only, every fly you see buzzing around is only the 15% of the total population you got in your property. The other hasn't got to that stage yet, so they're in the larval stage or the cocoon stage. And, you know, if you're using just traps and trying to catch it that way or just sprays, well, you get to spray and trap all summer because there's always going to be more coming. So once you use them, people will get used to, they won't put up with flies anymore because it's so easy and take get rid of them. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Hey.
Have a great day.
All righty. Okay. Bye-bye.
I feel my horse's tail swatting less already.
There you go. We never did get to hear about your new horse.
Well, we'll just have to save that for next time.
I guess so. Because yeah. You're going to start doing more trail stuff.
Well, I'm going to just do more stuff.
More stuff.
I don't know. Hey, guys, I don't know if we mentioned it. Did he mention the website name?
Yes.
It's Spalding-Labs.com, just in case you missed it.
There we go, because I missed it. So Spalding-Labs. Okay, got it. Well, I think that's a wrap today, Alice. We had a busy, bang-up show.
Yeah, we did.
You can find links to today's guests on our show notes page at horsesinthemorning.com. And you can follow for Horses in the Morning on Facebook. Just search for Horses in the Morning. Or you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @horseradio. And you can have all of the shows with you wherever you go when things aren't going live by getting our app for your iPhone or Android. It's quick and it's free. Go to your app store and search Horse Radio Network, and you can download it today, or you can subscribe via iTunes. And never miss an episode. There you go. And thank you very much to today's sponsors, NATRC and Spalding Labs.
And don't forget, tomorrow's Really Bad Ads Day. Send your ads in.
Send your ads
Jennifer
in.
JenniferHorseRadioNetwork.com.
Need more.
Get them in.
There we go. See you next time.
Bye.